Secretary of War Marco Rubio, I mean Secretary of State, forgive me for getting those two confused, but based on his testimony today on Capitol Hill, you would be forgiven for thinking that he was supposed to be the chief diplomat, and maybe you were thinking he's the chief offensive military guy, because that's kind of the, what he's talking about, which is part and parcel for our State Department to include the former, one of the former State Department officials that you're going to see here shortly. But you're going to see things are just turned topsy-turvy, upside down from anything that most of us grew up with, loving America, serving America, thinking the best of America. Those days are gone, folks. And I'm sorry to say this with such virility, but the evidence requires it. And if you are uncertain of that, well, let's see what I mean here. And we're going to bring on one of the show's our favorite guest, Larry the Shirt Johnson, former CIA intel analyst, author at sonar21.com, and son of the New American Revolution on substack.com. Larry, always love to have you on, but one of these days we're just going to have to come on and talk about something fun, like, I don't know, football or,
yeah, or potatoes. Potato salad recipes.
Potato salad recipes. That's what, you know.
There we go.
That would be a lot better than the recipe we're about to dissect today. Listen, let's just jump right into it here, because Marco Rubio is just, I don't know, and I'd like your view on this, when, on the backside of this clip, whether he is playing fast and loose with the facts, whether he knows the facts and is just saying, I'm just, have such contempt for the American people that I'll just tell them, you know, that this is a fruit salad or something like that. I don't know which it is. I'd like your view on it. But here is Marco Rubio sounding for the world like a Jeffersonian Democrat that just wants the world to get along.
What is our goal going in? We had in our hemisphere a regime operated by an indicted narco trafficker that became a base of operation for virtually every competitor, adversary, and enemy in the world. It was, for Iran, their primary spot of operation in the Western Hemisphere. For Russia, their primary base of operation in the Western Hemisphere, along Cuba and Nicaragua, was Venezuela. In the case of China, China was receiving oil at a huge, about $20 a barrel discount. They weren't even paying money for it. It was being used to pay down debt that they were owed. This is the oil of the people of Venezuela, and it was being given to the Chinese as barter. And so you had basically three of our primary opponents in the world operating from our hemisphere from that spot. It was also a place where you had a narco-trafficking regime that openly cooperated with the FARC and the ELN and other drug trafficking organizations using their national territory.
Sorry, I got those out of order. The next one is going to be where he's going to sound like Thomas Jefferson reborn. This one is where he's saying, oh, my God, you should be thanking Donald Trump and me because we have saved the world, especially this hemisphere, because there was a terrorist hotspot down in our hemisphere where China, Russia, North Korea, all the bad guys went. And thank God that we have now eliminated that. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, let's give Marco credit. He knows exactly what he's talking about in terms of the narcotics threat out of Venezuela. Because back in the 1980s, Marco Rubio lived with his brother-in-law, Orlando Cecilia. Orlando was married to Marco's older sister, Barbara. Oh, and then I mentioned that Orlando was arrested as part of a major cocaine trafficking ring in Miami in the 1980s. And he was arrested during the time that Marco was living with him. So Marco saw firsthand narcotics trafficking going on. I mean, the hypocrisy of these people is despicable. You know, they're manufacturing this lie that Maduro was this major narcotics trafficker, particularly with fentanyl. We got to go after him because he's causing deaths with fentanyl. Yet according to the State Department's INCSR, the International Narcotics Country Reports, the INSCR is its acronym, 99% of the fentanyl that's been seized over the last 10 years has been seized at the border with Mexico, not the border with Canada. 99%. And certainly, yeah.
99%. I did not know it was that
yeah.
high.
Yeah, it was that high. So well, I looked it up because I was looking it up because I was talking to somebody who was suggesting that the bigger percentage was coming through Canada. But no, it turns out it's almost entirely through Mexico. So this, oh, they're close to Russia. So Russia's not doing anything to attack us. We're the ones attacking Russia. We're the ones sponsoring terrorist attacks in Russia, for God's sake. And again, this notion with Iran sponsoring Hezbollah, please. Hezbollah didn't emerge until 1982. There are a number, what they're talking about are Shia Muslim merchants that are throughout Central and South America. And you've got, most of them are Shia, but a few of them are Sunni. And the Sunnis and Shia, they cooperate economically, but religiously, they're polar opposite poles. And so they manufacture this massive terrorist threat from Hezbollah that, you know, they've, the only attack where they were implicated was the attack on the Israeli embassy and cultural center in Buenos Aires back in, I think the first one was 92, second one was 94. That's been about it. So it's not like, you know, they're carrying out a terrorist attack every other week. But again, it's part of the lies.
Is there any legal justification? Is there any moral justification to say, okay, our hemisphere, our half of the world, we can decide, me being Washington, D.C., we can decide who can live there, who cannot, what the rules are. And if anybody, I don't know, say Venezuela, for a hypothetical example, says that we're going to do business with somebody from China, we're going to do business from Russia, we're going to do business from Iran, or even North Korea, for that matter, any of those countries, is there anything that can legally, rationally, morally authorize us to step in with lethal military force to prevent it?
No. This is completely immoral. This is the behavior of an imperialist, which is what we have become. Look, the truth of the matter, why did we go into Venezuela? To make money for Paul Singer. Paul Singer, a billionaire who is a major donor, contributor to Donald Trump's campaign. Singer owns three refineries. These oil refineries that are down along the Gulf Coast. You know, we used to call it Gulf of Mexico. Now it's Gulf of America. Those refineries are specially set up to process and refine Venezuelan oil. Venezuelan oil, you know, it's not like the oil that comes out of the ground in Permian, Texas. That comes out like a cup of coffee, you know, black crude, but you can, you know, suck it up through the ground pretty easily. Now, the stuff that comes out of Venezuela is like a half a cup of coffee mixed with peanut butter, a lot thicker. And it requires an additional $15 to $20 per barrel to refine. And gee, when you add up 700,000 barrels of oil getting refined at Paul Singer's refineries, it's going to make Paul Singer a cool $4 billion a year. That's why we did this. Pay off Paul Singer. There was no U.S. national interest involved at all.
Well, that's not quite the same story that we're hearing out of the administration or out of the Secretary of State. As a matter of fact, he went on right after saying what the objectives were and why it was so important for us to go in. He then lays out that it's really all about democracy, Larry.
The end state here is we want to reach a phase of transition where we are left with a friendly, stable, prosperous Venezuela and democratic, in which all elements of society are represented in free and fair elections. We're not going to get there in 3 weeks. It's going to take some time. And so objective number one was stability. In the aftermath of the removal of Maduro, the concern was what happens in Venezuela? Is there civil war? Do the different factions start going at each other? Are a million people crossing the border into Colombia? All of that has been avoided. And one of the primary ways that it has been avoided is the ability to establish direct, honest conversations with the people who today control the elements of that nation. Meaning the law enforcement, the government apparatus, etc. And one of the tools that's available to us is the fact that we have sanctions on oil. There is oil that is sanctioned that cannot move from Venezuela because of our quarantine.
It's all about the people, Larry. That's what you need to understand. We want to have a fair and honest conversation with the people that we are saying, do what we say or we will kill you,
yeah,
just like we kill these other people or grab you and take you into prison. That's all we're saying. We're just good guys here. How do you read that?
Yeah, I read it exactly that way. We're using force, coercion, threats, and violence to get our way. This isn't about respecting the will of the people of Venezuela. I mean, look, the reality was Hugo Chavez, as much as we disliked him, and one of the reasons we disliked him was he nationalized oil companies that belonged to us or belonged to the campaign contributors to U.S. presidents. Well, then they became enemy number one. But Hugo Chavez was popularly elected. That's called democracy. Now, there are there's controversy surrounding Maduro and his succession to Chavez, and I think what we can see in the this inside operation that was allowing Maduro to be arrested and taken out of, you know, abducted, kidnapped, taken out of the country, would imply that at least within a significant portion of what is now the elite establishment in Venezuela, they didn't like Maduro. Now that he's out of the way, institutionally, even the major political institutions that were in place under Maduro, they're still there. And the United States is kidding itself if it thinks it's going to control. We didn't put troops in for a very good reason, because it would there would be a civil war, and we would have casualties.
Yeah, I remember you were telling us, warning us about that for the ever since this first came up as a possibility, and we pulled the map out, and you talked about the route from the coast up to the capital, and how it had all these ambush places, et cetera, whatever. Obviously, SOUTHCOM looked at the map, and they said, you know, that's not a good idea. Let's don't do that. Let's just throw a bunch of missiles in there and steal the guy. How about that? So that's good so far, but. Now then, the next thing I want to show Rubio talking about here is that he's saying that after 4 weeks, the operation has gone far better than we could have imagined.
I am saying that in 3.5, almost 4 weeks, we are much further along on this project than we thought we would be given the complexities of it going into it. And I recognize that it won't be easy. I mean, look, at the end of the day, we are dealing with people over there that have spent most of their lives living in a gangster paradise. So it's not going to be like from one day to the next, we're going to have this thing turn around overnight. But I think we're making good and decent progress. It is the best plan, and we are certainly better off today in Venezuela than we were 4 weeks ago. And I think and hope and expect that we'll be better off in 3 months and 6 months and 9 months than we would have been had Maduro still been there.
And it just sounds like to me that he is just telling everybody there with a straight face, hardly doctoring much of this up, that we're going to use the country of Venezuela for our personal oil pump and financial capability, and we'll decide how much, if any, of their money they actually get. But as long as they cooperate, they won't get killed. And by the way, it's going so much better than we thought. Do you think that that's an accurate assessment?
No. Look, let's deal with the oil thing. The total amount of the oil that is produced right now in Venezuela is 700, maybe 800,000 barrels a day. That represents less than 2% of total global oil production by both OPEC and non-OPEC countries. If you think less than 2% of volume of oil is going to change anything, and on top of it, it is oil that is more expensive to produce. So let's say that all oil that's pumped out of the ground is pumped out at $40 a barrel. It costs an additional $15 to $20 per barrel for Venezuelan oil. So it's going to start off more expensive, requires a lot more effort to refine it. What we haven't seen, or I guess what Marco, Narco Marco is refusing to say, is that the CIA has had a penetration of Venezuelan assets for years. I mean, going back to the days of Carlos Andres Perez, who was the president before Hugo Chavez, Perez was a CIA asset. And so they've continued to have contacts both in the military and the intelligence, the two different intelligence services that are in Venezuela. So it's no surprise. And there are always people that disliked Chavez and disliked Maduro. We've been able to exploit that weakness. But there's a difference between exploiting that and being able to actually now go in and control. We still have our embassy, the Venezuelan embassy for the United States is still located in Colombia next door. Why? Because it's too damn dangerous to put Americans back in there.
Well, that does not augur well for the future. But actually, I got a separate question before I even move on to the next thing that Rubio tried to sell us. And that is, he made comment there that things are going better after 4 weeks, at least according to his interpretation of things. And he talked about how the regime is, the people that were left behind are working with this. You made mention of the fact that there was a strong insider component to this, which facilitated the whole thing. And some people in Venezuela are very happy to be rid of Maduro, but they just exchanged one correct me if I'm wrong, but one corrupt official for a different corrupt official. And so now somebody else is there. Do you see, or better question, to what difficulty do you see will the Trump administration have going forward to manage this situation, we'll say, if the people inside of Venezuela say, I still want to make a lot of money here, and if I'm not going to facilitate making myself poor so that you can keep raping all the money from what little oil we do produce, or do you see them trying to gum up the works a little bit and trying to drag their feet without responding or drawing a response?
Well, there are different groups. There's not one. It's not a monolith in Venezuela. And I'm not sure at this point to what extent the CIA has been able to co-opt one of those factions. And the key is always, if you've got a faction that you're controlling, are they in a position to actually control events and exercise dominant influence? I think the answer to that right now is no. And so we've in watching how North Americans, you know, the U.S. officials deal with both Central and South Americans over the year, there's very much a paternalistic arrogance about it. You know, we like pat them on the head, nice little brown people, and underestimate them repeatedly. And yet, in my experience, the folks down there are pretty clever. They're very smart, and they figure out how to run circles around us.
That's kind of what I was thinking, because it just human nature, even without knowing what they're like down there, it's human nature that if someone's coming and trying to steal all of your revenue, and yet they don't put an occupying army in the place here, that you have plenty of opportunity to smile as you're moving stuff around behind the scenes there so that you don't have as much to lose. Or so it just doesn't seem like this is going to run smooth very long.
Yeah, the key question is who inside Venezuela is the one that controls the oil? Is it PDVSA, PDVSA, is there a particular individual or one particular family? And then if that's the family, then that's who the United States is going to work with. And so it depends on that family, how well they're able to pay off other people to protect and preserve their position. I mean, this is how organized crime works. We just keep replacing one criminal with another criminal when we ourselves are the criminals.
So let me ask you a more fundamental question along those lines. In normal interstate affairs, you can have a good cooperative relationship with not even necessarily adversaries or not even necessarily friends, but with normal states, if that's a term, I'll just use it for now, but just a state, and that we want to have good relations with this state. There's some things that we can benefit from it, so we'll do trade, whatever the course is. And so we'll have something that has some version of a win-win so that we can get something. And it can last for decades in some cases, as long as the conditions, as long as both sides still benefit from it. Do you see this situation being able to maintain this win-lose dynamic to where these guys are put in charge as long as I pat them on the head and they do what they're told, and as they keep sending most of the revenue this way, can that be sustained?
No. And let's understand that the history of U.S. relations with Mexico, Central America, South America has been one of dominance, military, political, economic dominance, for at least going back to 1846 at the start of the Mexican-American War, when we invaded Mexico and took territory from Mexico that then created New Mexico, Arizona, California as U.S. territory, and Texas as well. So, you know, we've been doing the raping and pillaging of Central South America for almost 200 years. So we're not going to change. The only thing that changes is we have a short attention span when it comes to these countries. I mean, back when I was at the CIA and I was the Honduran analyst, my God, it was one of the top five foreign policy priorities for then President Ronald Reagan and later George H.W. Bush. I mean, I was writing for the Presidential Daily Brief twice a week at least. So it was a lot of attention. And then after 1990, we couldn't find Honduras on a map. You know,
Yeah.
So, and before, you know, Honduras could, you know, they'd have some pressure with us. You know, they could shake us down for more cash because we had a vested interest of keeping a CIA bases intact. But, you know, once they were no longer necessary, once the war with in both Salvador and Nicaragua died down, yeah, they could threaten us with whatever. And we said, we don't care. You know, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah, that is the issue, is that until we don't need you anymore, and it can languish along for a long time there, and it usually doesn't end up doing anybody any good. This particular case, Rubio said a second ago that, you know, after 4 weeks, it's going to be good, but he hopes that after 4 months or 6 months and on into the future, things would be continuing to get better. But if they don't, he also said the stick is still on the table.
I can tell you right now with full certainty, we are not postured to, nor do we intend or expect to have to take any military action in Venezuela at any time. The only military presence you'll see in Venezuela is our Marine guards at an embassy. But that said, if an Iranian drone factory pops up and threatens our forces in the region, the president retains the option to eliminate that threat.
I'm asking a more specific question. Do you agree that you have to come to Congress to get authorization if you are simply using force to try to compel cooperation?
Well, there's two things. There's the
It seems like
under the War Powers Act. No, under the War Powers Act, if we're going to be involved in something that's going to put us in there involved in a sustained way, we have to notify you within 48 hours after the fact. And then if it's going to last longer than 60 days, we have to come to Congress with it. We don't anticipate either of these things having to happen. Everything is moving in a very different trajectory right now. On the other hand, if we tell them we don't want to see drones from Iran, as an example, pointed at the United States or threatening our forces or our presence in the region or our allies' presence in the region, and they refuse to comply with that, the president does reserve the option in self-defense to eliminate that threat. We don't see that. We don't anticipate it. But it could happen. But we hope not. We don't want it to happen.
I'm sorry, Larry, but it absolutely drives me crazy when I hear people say that, and especially U.S. senators let it pass without comment, when Rubio says, oh, we can do whatever we want for 60 days, and then we have to notify Congress. No, that's not what the War Powers Act said. It says you can't even use them unless there's been first a congressional declaration of war, a congressional authorization, or you've been attacked. That's it. The list is only three, and it stops right there. This 60-day requirement says if, after they've been used, there's additional reporting requirements. That has been perverted and flipped up to become almost gospel to mean something it doesn't even mean at a cursory reading. And yet here's a U.S. senator, a political opponent, who left that. I mean, that's like a T-ball, man. You could have hit a home run, and you just left it sitting on the plate. I don't understand why they do that. But the bigger issue here, sorry for venting for a minute.
No, though.
The bigger issue here at the end of that clip there where he says, listen, if we need to attack in self-defense, we're going to inform you of it after the fact. What I hear there, you tell me, I'm obviously pretty aggravated here, so maybe I'm hearing extra things or not hearing others. But it sounds to me like he's saying we will use military force when and where and however damn well we play like it, and you'll say nothing except you'll pay the bills. How do you hear it?
I hear it exactly the same way. And they always trot out this lie that, you know, Iran wants to attack us. The history of U.S.-Iranian relations, starting with, you know, the U.S. attacking Iran in the 1953 with the overthrow of Mossadegh, is that it is the United States that encouraged Saddam Hussein of Iraq to start the war to attack Iran. And then we supplied him with precursor chemicals that were used to manufacture mustard gas. Now, we make a big deal about Iran's support as for proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah, how many people they killed. Well, the reality is Hamas and Hezbollah over since 1982 are responsible for the deaths of a maximum 5,000 Israeli civilians. However, the United States, by use of its proxy with Iraq, killed 500,000 Iranians, a half a million. Indeed, we wonder why they chant death to America. You know, the blood that the United States has on its hands of Iranians and of Shia throughout the region. Again, they go back, yeah, but Iran was behind the bombing of the Marines barracks in October 1983. Yeah, what did we do in September of 1983? Oh, yeah, that'd be, or we had a couple of battleships over there that were throwing these monster shells into the Bekaa Valley, killing Shia men, women, and children. That's why they retaliated. But now we push this crap, these lies out of people like Rubio. It's disgusting.
I'm going to shift gears here in just a second because I don't want to let you go before we get to some of the other pressing issues that are also on the table today. That's a lot more going on than just Rubio here. I wanted to talk about that, though, because of the fundamentals that it shows how they make decisions, as we're going to see, has some bleed over into some other big issues that are on the table right now. But before I leave that region, though, what is your understanding of just what in the holy hell is going on with Cuba, and why is the administration putting so much energy, emotional energy and political energy, into destroying the government in Cuba when they have not posed a threat to the United States since around 1962, I would wager?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they've got to subject themselves to us. They've got to obey us. They're not willing slaves. Look, Russia has drawn a line in the sand with respect to Cuba, and hopefully Donald Trump pays attention. Putin, in one of his recent speeches, made the point that Russia and Cuba have a strong history of relations. Putin never said anything like that with respect to Venezuela. So efforts by the United States to try to cut Cuban access to all oil, et cetera, I think is ultimately going to fail. But it comes back to, what are we going to do? We're going to, quote, control the government of Cuba? How? Are we going to send troops in to occupy? Yeah, you know, that didn't work out well with the Bay of Pigs.
Well, you know what I've heard, at least publicly, is that they want to try a slow strangulation death before the end of the year. So they actually want to strangle it economically so that it collapses, and then presumably people will rise up and throw off the shackles and all that kind of stuff. But let me just ask you, even if that is their plan, and I think that you might succeed on that because it is so poor, you might could have a version of a blockade that could cause, I mean, it would cause enormous damage and harm and death and suffering to the people, but you might get the government to collapse, et cetera. But man, is that moral?
No, it's not. There's no morality. We are Americans accuse me of being anti-American. Look, my relatives fought in the American Revolution. More than any, probably more than 95% of the people listening to your broadcast. So I'm not going to take any lectures from anybody about, quote, patriotism. But we got to come to a point where we step back and look at what we've done. During World War II, we routinely bombed civilians in Japan, in China, in other countries, in Germany. We routinely killed civilians, but we excused it because we were fighting for a good cause.
Sorry, man, we have to add North Korea to that list. We nearly leveled the entire North Korean country during the time we were trying to have the negotiated settlement. Not many people talk about that in the Western history. It doesn't ever make many history books, but I've looked at some of the documentaries on it, and it was just devastating how it was almost everything above ground was wiped out.
Yeah. Well, and ditto for Vietnam, and the wars in Central America. You know, we were responsible. Our proxies killed lots of civilians. So I said, you know, we always like to wrap ourselves in this morality that we don't live by. And that's what infuriates me with respect to these activities. It's usually there is an economic interest being served, and that economic interest is reserved for the few and the powerful, not for the average American, and certainly not for these foreigners that wind up being the victims.
There's a lot of that. Shifting gears now, let's go first over to Europe and to the Russia-Ukraine war. There was lots of noise, I'll say, that was made with these three-way talks that happened for the first time maybe in this war. United States, Ukraine, and Russia, and they met three times in Abu Dhabi. There was a bunch of speeches
twice.
Stuff made at Davos.
They met twice.
Was it twice? Okay, yeah. I thought there was three. They met twice. Lots of speeches given at Davos, and at the end of the day, it feels like nothing of it ever happened. Has anything changed since before all of these meetings?
No. The Trump administration keeps pushing the notion that there's been some deal and Russia is willing to make some territorial concessions. I had a conversation earlier today with the number two guy in the Duma in Russia, their state legislature, their national legislature, Alexander Babakov. Russia is not going to give up one sliver of territory in Crimea, in Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, or Luhansk. Now, do they control all of Zaporizhia and Kherson right now? No, they do not. But they're not going to cede that as any part of negotiated settlement. Not going to happen. Is it possible that they would make concessions with respect to Novorossiya, which would include Dnipropetrovsk, Poltava, Sumy, and Kharkiv? That's possible, because those oblasts have not voted yet to become part of Russia. But if they do vote to become part of Russia, Russia will keep them too. So this meeting that they had was with military. Now, Rubio announced today that this next meeting, Witkoff and Jared Kushner would not be involved, which means now that they're responding to what the Russians have asked for, that if you're serious about negotiations, State Department and Foreign Ministry will get together. That really hasn't happened yet at a high level. So we'll see if that comes to pass. But Russia's position has not changed. In fact, they realize they're winning on the ground. This is not like a T-ball for eight-year-olds where you call the mercy rule, okay? The one team's ahead 20-1, and okay, we're going to call it quits. Everybody's a winner. Everybody gets a participation trophy. That's not going to happen here. And particularly at the company grade level and at the NCO level within the Russian military, the thing they fear the most is that they'd get betrayed by politicians. And Putin knows that. So they're not going to cut a deal just to satisfy Donald Trump and whatever he wants for his political ambitions.
Now, there was an interesting development also. It was 3 or maybe 4 days ago now. I can't remember exactly when it first hit the airwaves. But Volodymyr Zelensky came out and very brashly said that we now have a 100% agreement with the United States on security guarantees. And we're just waiting for the signing ceremony. That's it. But we've got everything solved. Now, it's interesting because I've been looking every day and I haven't seen anybody on the American side say, oh, yeah, we got that all locked in. We're just going to sign it. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's just Zelensky lying. Because let's assume that that's true. Russia's not going to accept that. I mean, what security guarantees that the United States and or other NATO troops will be based in Ukraine to provide Ukraine? Russia's not going to accept. That's the problem. NATO is the problem. Now, I've wondered if Donald Trump had made a secret agreement with Putin at Anchorage where he said, hey, what? Tell you what, I know how to get NATO off your back. I'm going to invade Greenland and piss off Denmark, and it will implode, and that way gets NATO off your back. And if you'll help us explore and get some access to the resources in the Arctic, and I could see Putin going, "All right, sounds pretty good. Let's see." And Putin's sitting back now with the popcorn, just eating, watching, NATO implode, and Mark Rutte's going, "Daddy, Daddy, don't leave us." Daddy, please don't leave us.
Mark Rutte, boy,
what a freak show this is.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. We'll just stick on the same topic here. And since you brought up Mark Rutte, what do you make of his comment? I think it was the day before yesterday, where he said, "Hey, listen, folks, we cannot. We being NATO, we cannot defend ourselves without the United States. You can figure it. You got to go up to 10% of GDP. So don't even worry about it." I mean, it was so odd to me. Tell me how you heard it, because I'm twisted here a little bit from history, but it sounded to me like he was saying, okay, Europe, let's stay subservient to the United States. No matter what Trump has done, let's just do whatever he says and make sure we keep ourselves vulnerable so that we require them to be part of it. Is that what I heard?
Yeah. Thank you. That was Captain Obvious speaking. We used to call it no shit analysis at, for stating the obvious that Rutte came to it. Of course, that's true.
But Larry, shouldn't the leader of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, who comes from a European country said, hey, we can't defend ourselves without the United States. We need to step up our game right now and start providing for our own defense. If nothing else, to say that. But he didn't. He just said, forget about it. Don't just, you keep dreaming, as it says on that headline right there. What do you make of that?
Yeah, NATO is in the position of a battered spouse. A battered spouse who refuses to call the police, a battered spouse who refuses to get a restraining order, and a battered spouse who refuses to pack her bags and say, "You are a mean, vicious bastard. I'm leaving you." No, they stick around so they can take another beating. I mean, it's embarrassing, it's humiliating, but you know, the Europeans are showing, you know, they'd much rather put up with the abuse than exercise any kind of sovereignty. And you saw just the other day, they said, yeah, and we don't want to buy any more Russian oil at all. Anybody that does, we're going to punish them. Oil and gas. No, we want to pay those higher prices from the United States.
Some of those old friends you mentioned are probably like going, yay. Yeah. I love NATO. Now, that's on the military front, but on the economic front, there's also some interesting dynamics that coming out of Davos and some of Trump's other less than appealing beatings to the spouse in your analogy there. And you have Mark Carney economically saying, you know what, these Chinese over in BRICS, that's looking pretty good. I'm going to start going there. You had Ursula von der Leyen for the European Union say, and you know, over India, another BRICS, that's something we should have a good deal to. Both of them said is to minimize leverage and flexibility of the United States. What do you make of that development?
Well, in fact, I don't know if you've been paying attention to the gold and silver market over the last 14 days.
I have very much so. Yes, it's been skyrocketing.
It has gone through the roof. It's not without, we've had historical precedent. Gold popped to these levels back in the early 1980s, but it was in the midst of an international crisis. Similarly with silver. But apart from that, this is really unprecedented what's taking place right now. And part of what is causing this spike is that countries like China and India that have traditionally held U.S. Treasury bills are selling them off, and they're buying up gold and silver in place. And in fact, other BRICS nations are doing the same. And the revenues, the percentage of revenues held in U.S. dollars have declined from like 60% to 40%. BRICS.
That's
BRICS,
a big hit.
Yeah, it's a big number. And increasingly, last September and October, the biggest buyers of U.S. treasuries were the Europeans. And what does Trump do to them? Basically walks in, kicks them in the balls, shits on their head, and beats up their wife, and then walks out and said, hey, would you buy some more treasuries?
Buy some more. Yeah, if you don't mind on your way out.
I mean, and so it's been in the aftermath of that now that you see Starmer's heading to China. And then the EU's announced this new trade deal with India, and Carney's looking to China. So Trump's personal charm offensive that he announced, remember last February, he said countries are lining up to kiss my ass.
He said that
it hasn't gone too well. The demand for chapsticks way down. Okay, people aren't having to lubricate their lips to plant them on Trump's ample cheeks. Instead of cultivating, trying to be friendly with these people, hey folks, we really appreciate your assistance and glad you're buying our treasures. Hey, we got some more to buy. Would you like that? No, I think the Europeans are going to start moving away from that as well. Because what you see is there's a complete split between the paper market. You know, people can buy options. You know, they'll short the stocks, or they want to put puts on it, where they can put the price out at a certain thing. And you buy what are called ETFs. And then the actual hard metal, what you're buying and selling, there is an arbitrage gap of about $20 between New York City, where they're wanting to sell it now at $113 an ounce, and in Shanghai, China, where they're offering to buy it at $127. So if you buy, you know, you buy 1 million ounces of silver, you sell 1 million ounces out of New York City at 113 to Shanghai, where they're paying you 127, you know, just do the math, 14 times, you make $14 million. And the shipment of that is like 50 cents an ounce to ship it. So it's, the shipment's minimal. And as that silver and gold continue to flow to China, China's building up its reserves. And so this is what we're witnessing, is the transformation of our international financial system.
I wanted to go down that path a bit here. If I get outside your area of expertise, just let me know. But there was also at the Davos meeting, they got less headlines, at least in the foreign policy stuff, but definitely got my attention, was it was, I can't remember all the guys. It was Ray Dalio and several other big name economic guys. They had a panel sitting there. And one of the, I think the guy's name was Ken something. I can't think of his last name right off the top of my head, but he said something that really got my attention. He said that, like in the 2008, economics backside we had, the state banks, federal banks and whatnot, were able to print their way out of it, in the West especially, right? Now then, he said, we are in a state where that flexible leverage is gone. And he said the state banks are the ones who are printing right now. They're printing basically debt because they have nothing else to go back to. And he said that it's unsustainable. The system has become now unsustainable. He said the only thing that can save us right now is AI. If AI can add basically orders of magnitude productivity improvements out of the same capital inflows, he said, then we can live to fight another day. But he said, if we don't, the system is going to collapse. That is the biggest warning bell that I had seen. And oil, I'm sorry, the price of gold went way up after he said that, and has continued to rise even as of today. It's another big spike. It sounds to me like we're just waiting for that other shoe to drop. And it appears to me, and I'm not a financial expert, so forgive me if I'm reaching the wrong conclusion here, but at least my gut tells me that we're already over the top and we can't rescue this one. And we're now just waiting to find out when the thing hits the ground and everything starts to collapse. How do you see it?
Yeah. So one of the things that's taking place, one of the ways that they're trying to control, manage the rise in the price of silver and gold, is when people would place a bet, it's called shorting a stock. If you place a bet that in 6 months, this silver is only going to be worth $50. So I'm going to buy the right to put the silver, you know, I'm going to make a bet that that's what's going to happen. And so you only have to put up a fraction of money for that contract. But the people who issue those contracts and say, so let's say that you're making a $100 bet, but to cover that $100 bet, all you have to do is just give me a dollar. Okay. That's all. And then I'll allow that bet to go forward. But when the risk gets to a certain level, one way you can control it is to say, oh, no, I need $20 from you now to hold that $100 bet. And a lot of these guys that are, you know, it's called a margin call, they don't have the money to, you know, they have to sell their position at whatever the price is. So if you had made the bet that silver was going to go down to 50, but instead it's selling at 113, you literally have to go out on the market and buy at 113 in order to pay off the amount that you said was lower. So they lose money. And so in that margin call, you can have have the start of financial collapse. Now, one of the big differences is the paper is worthless. What we're talking about is actual silver and actual gold and what are the volumes. And one of the things that's happened in the last week, and I've seen it personally, the mining stocks for silver, they were all set up and their profit models were based upon silver at like $50 an ounce. Well, now it's $113 to $130 an ounce. So their costs of mining are fixed. Those aren't variable. So now they're printing money. And I saw one mining stock that I actually happened to buy. It started at $7. It's up it's to $11 now in just a week. That's almost, 50%, it's well over a 50% gain. So that's what, and that's taking place across the mining sector now, because what's happened is there is not enough silver, because it's not just, you know, you go back 40 years ago, you know, when you and I were kids, silver was used for photography, you know, for film.
Yeah.
You know, you and I remember what cameras were. You tell it to this younger generation going,
a what?
What do you mean? You know,
your phone
and for, you know, for you, the tea set your grandmother had and the, and knives and forks. Okay. That's basically where the silver demand was. Now the silver demand is, do you know how many ounces of silver are in a Tomahawk missile?
I don't.
4,000.
Whoa. Are you serious?
I'm 4, serious.
4,000?
Yeah. I heard it was either 400 or 4,000.
One Tomahawk missile.
One Tomahawk missile. A huge number. Silver's in, oh, in these solar panels. Silver's in these electric vehicles. So there's an actual industrial demand for silver, coupled with these countries now that are saying, we no longer have any faith in the U.S. dollar. So we're going to now, we want to bolster it with silver and with gold. So the supply has shrunk. And so these mining companies, man, they're going to be making a lot of money hand over fist by mining silver. And then the facilities that, you know, when people take their grandma's tea set to the market to try to sell it, well, there's a hold on that right now because the smelters, the people that melt it down and then turn it into actual raw silver, a couple of them have shut down for now. So there's a bottleneck there. So what I'm saying is just this entire commodities market with silver and gold is in complete upheaval. And I think, I'm hoping, that may actually be a contributing factor that will help put the brakes on Donald Trump attacking Iran. Because if he does go forward with an attack on Iran, the rush for gold and the rush for silver will go through the roof.
Right, and that's exactly what I was about to say. You took the segue right out of my mouth, but let's go there since you brought that up. Last night at basically a campaign rally, Trump got a big applause line on this.
And by the way, there's another beautiful armada floating beautifully toward Iran right now. So we'll see. I hope they make a deal. I hope they make a deal. They should have made a deal the first time they'd have a country.
We're going to talk about the whole deal-making part there in a second, but let's focus, first of all, to me, that was kind of a disturbing image there, because it's like a campaign rally. He's getting an applause line for talking about a military armada that could be poised and ready to strike. And there is, number one, no congressional authorization. There's nothing in American law that would allow. We haven't been attacked. And I don't know what we're supposed to gain from this and how we're supposed to succeed. And even militarily, can we succeed? Let's start with that one.
No, we cannot succeed. If military success is defined as the destruction of the Islamic Republic and the replacement of the Islamic government with a non-sectarian leadership, not going to happen. And you can't do it with just missile strikes alone. Well, first of all, we don't have the troops on the ground capable of doing that. You know, as you recall, the buildup for 2003, that took about 8 months to build up enough troops to launch that invasion of Iraq. And only in this case, Iran is, four times larger.
Gary, can you put up that full screen we used earlier today with the map and the Abraham Lincoln? But yeah, that one right there. This kind of reinforces what you're saying there. There's a lot of combat power here, but it's sea and air power. I don't see, other than a handful of Marines, there's no ground here. What would that tell Iran?
Yeah, just tells Iran that they're going to have to get close. They're going to have to get close enough to launch missiles. But see, Iran's got missiles that are capable of reaching what we fire. And they've also had their capabilities bolstered by Russia and China. And let's say, you know, let's start talking tactics. If I'm the Iranians right now, I'm starting to place missiles ready to launch outside, except they're dummies. They're decoys. but I'm going to make visible targets for U.S. targeters to go after. And it's the kind of thing that they will be able to, attract U.S. fire and then expand on, Tomahawk missiles. The United States only has a limited number of Tomahawk missiles. We don't have an unlimited supply.
One of the reasons we didn't give them to Zelensky.
Yeah. Right, right.
One of the reasons.
Yeah. So where
is this going? Because as I read the tea leaves here and see all the signs, and I could show you a whole ton of sound bites. In fact, let me just show you one here of those who are absolutely lusting for this and doing everything they can to compel compliance on Donald Trump for this attack. Let's start with the former Secretary of War, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo.
This is not that complicated. This regime has to go at this point. There's no deal. There's no agreement. President Obama tried that path. He led to continue their nuclear program. President Biden tried to do the same thing. This is not a regime that could be negotiated with. This is a regime that is going to have to be forced from power by the Iranian people, and the United States can provide support for that.
They can only be forced from power. They can't negotiate, i.e. they're Neanderthals. All you can do is kill them. How do you see it?
Yeah, okay, so who's calling the shots here, Pompeo or Trump? Because Trump just said we're trying to negotiate. Negotiate what? Foreign Minister Araghchi in comments this morning said, I've had zero contact with Rubio or anybody from State Department. So the idea of negotiations is you give them a call and say, hey, here's what we're demanding. What are our demands?
Well, according to Axios, by the way, Gary, if you can throw those up there, from the full screen there, it says, that one right there. This is what Axios is reporting. U.S. officials say any deal would have to include the removal of all enriched uranium from Iran, a cap on Iran's stockpile of long-range missiles, a change in Iran's policy of supporting proxies, and a ban on independent uranium enrichment. That's all we're asking. It's not that much, is it?
Well, wait a second.
Everything that exists.
What's he talking about? He obliterated it.
Oh, that's right.
You can't give up what you obliterated. Yeah, I mean, Trump is so full of horse manure, they just make it up as they go along.
But so that headline Gary's showing right there. Trump says that if Iran doesn't do this deal, he's going to make it, quote, far worse. You had the Iranian, I don't think it was Araghchi, maybe it was. He said that this will be the worst we've ever done. You have Netanyahu also said that if we are attacked in a result of this, this will be unimaginable. Everybody on all the sides of this are using these really flourishing language of a lot of violence coming. Do you see it all being just a bunch of words?
No. I think even though Trump has a reputation for chickening out, the taco reference, Trump always chickens out. I think the inertia, the momentum behind this thing has taken on a life of its own. And, they caught Iran by surprise on June 13th. And then Iran limited its strikes, particularly they cut a deal with the United States. There was a deal that, basically the U.S. was allowed to bomb the nuclear sites up north, and Iran was going to strike Al Udeid after U.S. had evacuated its personnel, and then we'd call it quits. But in exchange for that, Iran got permission from the United States that it could then export oil to China. So that was the deal. So the United States reportedly...
Funny, Caroline Leavitt didn't talk about that deal.
Yeah. Better left unsaid. Then... yesterday there were press reports that Iran said, hey, we've been approached by the United States with Trump basically saying, hey, just, let me drop a few bombs and then we'll, go on with our, and Iran said, hell no, you do that, it's going to be total war. They didn't do total war last time. So this time they will strike every U.S. military base in the region. They will kill U.S. military personnel. They will attack U.S. naval platforms.
And I don't think we have it up in front of us here, but what do you say to Jack Keane, who I want to say it was yesterday, said, oh, well, they won't. It's not like we're going to get into a war with Iran. They don't want to get into a war with us because then they know they'll be totally destroyed. So they will pull their punches, so to speak. What do you say to that?
You mean like we totally destroy the Houthis? Is that what he's talking about? I mean, for God's sake, these guys, like we destroy the Ukrainians? You know, we have destroyed the Ukrainians. We haven't destroyed the Russians. You know, that's where we miss. We destroy the wrong ones. Oh, sorry, guys. We didn't mean to kill you all there. No, this is, look, Iran, by virtue of its size, I emphasize again, 4 times the size of Iraq. Now, you know, and I know, you know, I was on the ground in 2006 in Iraq, you know, flew out of Al Udeid. And I think, and I was on a C-130, and my God, you talk about a long flight. We had to fly to like Fallujah and drop off some Marines and then pick up some new, and then we flew back. I made 2 different combat landings in Iraq before we arrived at Balad. And that was a big, long flight. We had air supremacy. We didn't have to worry about, except when you're landing at the airport, they did the combat landings, you know, you're swirling down because they're afraid some guy might pop up with an surface-to-air missile and take you out. But Iran's 4 times that size. They've got at least, and this is according to Alistair Crook, who's been on the ground and inspected the sites. Hmm. They have hundreds of missile launch sites throughout Iran. We only got like 350 Tomahawks. And so the problem we're going to run into is we don't know if we're going to be bombing a decoy or bombing a real thing. And we know in a recent Tomahawk strike, and I think it was in Nigeria, it was intended, 30% of the Tomahawks didn't work. So
30%.
Yeah. They crashed.
So. Go through it because I'm running a little bit low on time here, but walk through the pros and cons from the Iranian point of view of doing what Iraqi and several of these others said, that no, if you do anything, we're going after your bases and we're going after Israel, because that would certainly prompt a lot of response, a lot of retaliation, and certainly get a lot of Iranians killed, a lot of stuff blown up. But why would they take that risk to go ahead and attack the United States this time?
Because they know that if they don't stop the United States, they'll keep coming after them. I mean, look, we've been attacking Iran now for 46 years. We started with using a proxy named Saddam Hussein back in 1980, encouraged Saddam to attack the Iranians, gave the Iraqis all of the what they needed to make mustard gas, helped them do the mustard gas attacks. They killed, during the course of that war, around 500,000 Iranians. Hell, Pat Lang, my former mentor, Pat was the chief of the Middle East division at DIA. He was hand-carrying intelligence to the government of Iraq to be used against the government of Iran. So we got a long history of attacking these people and trying to kill them. And, you know, when the history's written, they're the ones that have been seeking to have negotiations with us and get along. We've been the aggressor in this relationship, but that's not how we tell the story in the West. We make them the bad guy, we're the good guy, and we just ignore our own bloody hands in the process.
And where, to the extent that you can, I mean, there's always 100 ways things can play out. But just walk through a few potential scenarios for the United States. If we go in with any level of an attack, and Iran makes good on its threat and starts to take on, say, targets at Al Udeid, and maybe some of the bases in Kuwait or maybe Bahrain, and some of our ships maybe that are bored in there, and we start actually taking hits, what happens next? Because it seems like that there will be all the predictable people like Pompeo, et cetera, will then be pulling their hair out on fire, screaming for full-on war and everything else. Or will they? I don't know. I don't mean not assume, because then I don't think anybody wants to put boots on the ground in this 4 times larger than Iraq scenario. How would it play out?
Yeah. So let's go with what could be the most optimistic scenario, that as a result of Iran warning what it's going to do, that countries like China, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, those who are dependent upon oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf, begin to put enormous diplomatic pressure on the United States, on the Trump administration, to put a stop to this, because they recognize that if Iran is attacked, Iran's going to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, has all the capability to do so. That will disrupt about 45% of the flow of oil to the rest of the world from that location. And bears the economic consequence for Russia. The oil will spike to $150, $200 a barrel. Who knows? Russia will be making money hand over fist because its oil supplies aren't going to be affected. So you could have a potential diplomatic walk back. But that would require the United States to start withdrawing some of these military assets. If the attack takes place, Iran's strikes will be immediate. Remember what we saw on the June 13th attack. That was a completely unexpected decapitation. Several key political and military leaders were killed. And yet Iran was firing back within 9 hours. They now know the attack's coming. They have no doubt about that. They have put in place, the commanders of different units have already had their replacements identified. They've already been told, if you die, this is who's going to take in charge. So they've made the preparations for replacing. They reckon, hey, we're going to lose lives. We're going to be killed. Meanwhile, the Shia throughout the region. So like take the United Arab Emirates. They're a bunch of Sunni rulers, but the majority of the population there are Shia Muslims. And they're going to put out a fatwa. If they try to kill the Ayatollah Khamenei, they've already established, and this came out of Iraq yesterday, a worldwide global fatwa to kill Americans. Okay? So this thing is going to escalate dramatically. Could Israel possibly use a nuke? Yeah. But there's a, you know, they don't have a nuke that covers all of Iran. Because if they did that, they'd be facing a nuclear attack from Pakistan, from Russia, from China. You know, they're not going to get away with doing that. So, this is going to create a global financial crisis on top of being putting us on the cusp of a nuclear war, and this kind of reckless talk by Donald Trump and others with Jack Keynes and Lindsey Graham. It's evil. It's an expression of evil. We got to avoid it.
Let's pivot over one factor over. Go back to the region we talked about a minute ago, the Russia-Ukraine war. In the event that all that you described starts playing out in the Middle East, what is that going to do for the war effort in Ukraine? Because now all of a sudden we're not going to have any, not one air defense interceptor missile to give, because we're going to be covered in every single one of them we have, probably pulling them back from some of the people who already have them. What does that do to that war?
You'll see Europe then start scrambling for a deal with Russia. They're going to do a complete 180, or as Annalena Baerbock called it, a 360. But, you know, sorry, can't let that one go without a shot. But no, the air will come out of Ukraine. But Russia at that point will have bigger fish to fry. I think this will also put an end to negotiations between Russia and China. I mean, Russia and the United States. So this is, you know, I can't rule out that there are some moves, diplomatic moves being made behind the scenes to keep this thing from escalating. But Iran right now has made it clear to all of its friends as well. I think that's part of the reason they're being so public about this. If we get hit, we're taking the gloves off completely, and they've got the ability to take the gloves off. That's what the West is failing to
correct me if I'm wrong, but the objectives for success for the United States and the objectives for success for Iran are radically different. For us, we would have to have a complete decapitation that denudes their entire leadership and makes the resulting IRGC and everything else subservient to us. We have to achieve that level of success. Iran merely has to not die and right. can be able to fight indefinitely. Do you see it any different?
Well, not only that, when they survive this attack and the United States seeks to try to, you know, appease, Iran will then build a nuclear weapon. Because they will have realized that because they didn't have a nuke, they got attacked. If you got nukes, you don't get attacked. That will be one of the outcomes of this if it goes hot.
Now, Ted Postol, a few months back on our show, I think the last time that when Trump hit the Fordo and all those other sites in the past, he suggested that they probably ahead of time got enough material and centrifuges into an undisclosed location that if they needed to, they could race to a bomb even then.
Yeah, I think Ted's right. But it has been for religious reasons up to this point that they have not built a nuke because it is against their religion. They do take their religion seriously. That's the one thing that we refuse to accept. This aggression, remember, this was supposed, this military action was supposed to take place on January 13th, January 14th.
Yep.
But it was disrupted because with the assistance of Russian and Chinese electronic warfare capabilities, they shut down the Starlink network that was being used to coordinate strikes inside Iran. And so they had to hold off. They've used the ensuing 2 weeks to reposition forces now. So I think they're going to try to do it. They'll probably try to do it by the end of this week, if it's going to happen.
The consequences and the risks here are just off the charts every way you want to look for the Western right. world, not just the U.S. national security or economic security. I just cannot for the life of me understand why anyone's going to want to gamble with this. And yet I see the Pompeos, the Keens, the Lindsey Grahams, just bloodlust to do this. It appears to me, and tell me if you agree or disagree, that this cast of people, which seems to have a lot of influence on Trump, and we know Netanyahu does, because he could care less what it costs to us if he can use us to go after Iran, that's two thumbs up for him. But I think that maybe they have become so arrogant that they think all these things that you and I have talked about over this hour plus here and all these big risks and rocks in the water, that they're like, nah, that won't happen to us. We'll be able to do it anyway. I know that those things exist, but we'll be able to navigate around them. Everything will be just fine. Do you think that's the case? Or do you think that they actually are oblivious? I don't know what it is.
No, I think it's the arrogance and hubris. You know, you and I, I'm older than you. but
you're my elder. I acknowledge.
Yeah. But as we've observed over, you know, the last 66 years, Vietnam, Iraq twice, Afghanistan, Somalia, Libya, Panama,
Syria.
There's never a plan and strategic vision. It's like, okay, let's do this and we'll figure out the details later.
Venezuela.
There's no plan. And they always go with the assumption about how great we are, except, you know, we're like the football coach talking about him being the greatest coach ever, except he's never won a Super Bowl and his team consistently finishes last.
Other than that, definitely.
I'm a great coach.
Yeah, I worry about this one, Larry. I got to tell you, I fear that this could be a reconciling moment, if that's the right word. Maybe there's a better one, resetting even, like in the universal kind of sense, because you can't be arrogant and ignore the fundamentals and the rocks in the sea for forever without finally hitting one. And I fear that this may be our moment. I don't know. Maybe it's not. I thought it might have happened before and it didn't, but something in my gut tells me we're not in a good place here.
This is worse. So the only thing we can hope is that between the Russians and the Chinese, they're negotiating behind the scenes and trying to talk some sense into the United States. But we can't deny the enormous influence that the Zionists have on Trump, from Susie Wiles to Marco Rubio to John Ratcliffe. And in this case, common sense will be run over with this commitment to the Zionist cause, and we'll pay the price.
Well, we'll wait and see how it's going to work out. If anything does happen, look to your phone, because I'm sure Gary will be calling you right away to get you lined up to come on here and to give us some quick reacts. But I hope it doesn't happen, but my gut just tells me it's not a good feeling.
You and me both, brother. You and me both.
All right. Well, appreciate you, man. Be sure and go to sonar21.com. Don't wait for Larry to be back on our show. That's where you can always find the best of his stuff. We go there, too. Go to our own place here. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Podcast Addict. Anywhere you get podcasts, you can type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive and you'll find us there. Share that with your friends, folks. We are unintimidated and uncompromised to give you the no kidding truth here that you just hardly get on any other network. Don't get hardly on any major networks and not that many other podcasts. Share the wealth. Don't keep that all to yourself. We appreciate you folks, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.